First of all, thank you for coming out tonight to hear me speak, and I just thank the Lord every time I get to tell this story. Sometimes when I'm telling this story, it's almost like I'm beside myself thinking, wow, I never could have written this. I never would have had the boldness to write the story that I'm going to tell you tonight. And it amazes me what God has done. I'll tell you what, when you win $500,000 on a show which has been called the Olympics of Wilderness Survival, it's a mountaintop moment. It's a peak experience in a life. And there's two things I don't want you to get to take away from this story tonight. Number one is that if you do business with God, he's going to cut you a big check. That prosperity gospel thing ain't a thing. And I actually have never had to turn down a meeting at a church that preaches the prosperity gospel because they don't even get that far. And that's not a thing. The other thing is that I don't want you thinking about is that, oh, he must be a strong man for spending 66 days surviving, living off the land on the north end of Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Because that also is not the case. That is not true. And I hope this story will bear it out. Now, if you're going to buy a diamond, you go to the jeweler and you're going to buy that diamond for your wife or your fiance, and that jeweler's not going to take that diamond, set it down on a glass countertop, and show you that diamond. What's he going to do? He takes that piece of black velvet, right? Or black felt, and he lays that out, and he puts that diamond against a black background, a dark background. And that moment, that thing stands out. That's what I'm going to do tonight about winning alone. Because that story, if that's all you knew about the story, you would have the wrong impression that the Lord put that story in my life on a very background, a very dark thing that happened. Now, I got saved when I was 16 years old. I'm from Pennsylvania, grew up in the Westchester area, and I received Christ at a camp out in Colorado with Young Life. And when I was 16 years old, and I came back, and everything changed. At the same time, my dad, who later quit drinking, but at the time he was an alcoholic, engineer at Boeing, brilliant man, but on the weekends and at night, we were getting tossed around the house, and it was not good. In fact, when I went out to Colorado at that camp, I was running away from home. I figured if I ran from Pennsylvania, they'd find me and bring me back. If I ran from Colorado, I'd had a chance. And I was pretty good in the wilderness, and I had a backpack and $200 of cash and extra boots, and I was going to go to this Christian camp and then bolt from there, and ended up receiving Christ as my Savior, understanding the gospel for the first time in my life at 16 years old, after having gone to a Presbyterian church for 14 years, never understood the gospel, that Jesus was God, that he had a plan for my life, that he died on that cross for me. That was news for me at 16 years old. And you see these 16-year-old kids running around today, and you think, oh, these little punks running around. They've probably never heard the gospel. Okay, that's your job. Anyway, somebody got to me with the gospel, and I got saved, and I came home, and things started to change for me. At the same time, my refuge was the wilderness. If things were bad at home, I would just take off for the woods. And at that point, we had a house up in the mountains, and rather than hear my dad screaming and yelling and fighting with my mom, we'd just say, hey, drop us off on the mountain on Friday, pick us up Sunday on the way home, and we're good. And every weekend, I was spending out on the mountains with my brother, and we would just go out there, and it lit a fire under me. How do you survive in the wilderness? How do you live out there and not, how do you mitigate all those obstacles and problems and challenges? And to me, it just lit a fire in my head. And I had always, as a kid, I was fascinated with the American Indians and just, how do you live in the wilderness? And it became a passion. So at 16 years old, I've got this one rail in my life, which is Jesus Christ and the Word of God, and that is saving me. And then there's this other rail, which is the wilderness, which also is my refuge. And throughout my entire life, those two things are like parallel tracks that run throughout my entire story. Well, we're going to fast forward a little bit. I was Baptist Bible College, now Clark Summit University at Baptist Bible College. And I'm studying to be a Christian school teacher, and I met a girl who was a missionary kid from Brazil, and we ended up getting married. 1989, we get married, and I did a two-year short term in Brazil. We had the chance to go down to Brazil, to Belo Horizonte, Brazil, and teach American missionary kids for 2 years. And for me, it was a big adventure. For me, it was just a way to understand this other side of my wife. She'd answer the phone, and all of a sudden, she'd switch into Portuguese, and it's like, whoa. And she's like a whole other channel in there. You could just flick the, and I got to go to Brazil and learn that whole other side and understand, you know, the culture she grew up in and all that. And after 2 years with our first child in tow, Aaron, who was born in Brazil, 1991, it was time to come home. And there was some deer, you know, here in the United States that had not been shot. They were running around alive, and I had not killed them. And I wanted to go home. You know, I was done with this adventure, this Brazil thing. And came home, got a job teaching in a Christian school. And I knew when I left Brazil that I was supposed to come back as a missionary. I knew it. You know, the day we were leaving, a couple days before we left, we're at the sports center, and there's this indoor soccer field, about the size of this room, you know. And I remember coming around the corner, and there was all these people, which in time past were not a people, but now are the people of God. And I didn't know what the reference was, you know. But I knew the Holy Spirit was quoting scripture at me. And I saw those people out there that now knew God. And I am that royal priest in the chosen nation, God's special possession. Why? To declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Okay, that was what God gave me as I'm leaving Brazil. And I'm like, Lord, okay, but eventually, right? Someday soon, I'll do that. And I came home, started teaching in a Christian school in the States. It was an absolute miserable experience. The ministry was great. The school was a nightmare. Very abusive school. And teaching inner city kids from Chester, Pennsylvania. And it was a great experience, but this is no place to land my career. And we went down in 1994, went down for the summer to Brazil, and it was like coming home. And I knew, this is where I'm supposed to be. And I came back, and I bent the knee to God's call. And I remember at school, I'm standing there the next day after I told God, after a message, yeah, I'll go back to Brazil as a church planting missionary. And I'm standing there kind of directing the kids' traffic at the school, and the buses are there, and there's this bus park next to me. And it opens up, and there's this old guy, old black guy. He's got a big afro and this long, pointy beard. He says, young man, you look very troubled. And I'm like, out of the blue, who is this? You know, and I was troubled. And I told him, I ain't got nothing to lose. I say, yeah, God's calling me to be a missionary, and I've got to give up steady employment, go out and raise support, and just trust the churches now to be able to do this. And I got a wife and a kid. And he says, I was once young, but now I'm old. But I've never seen the righteous forsaken nor their children begging for bread. Slides that door shut, drives off. I'm like, that was exactly the thing that I needed to hear. And here I am standing there just troubled and worried and all this stuff. And it's like, God's like, cue the wise man. Talk to that guy out there. Speak some wisdom into him, you know? Anyway, as Randy said, we candidated with the mission in 1995, and he invited me to do a 2-year internship. Ended up 2.5 years we were there at his church. He was teaching me how to preach and how to pastor and all that. And then it was time to raise support. Another 2.5 years of raising support. Our second child came along, 1999. We were fully funded and ready to go, and off we were to Brazil as church planting missionaries. So you think about it, I graduate from BBC there in 1989. 1999, we're just arriving on the field. Now I've got a 1-year internship, well, 1 year of language study I had to do, and learned how to speak Portuguese. You know, I was already pretty good, but I needed a year of language study, and then a whole year for internship at a Brazilian church downtown in Belo Horizonte. So we're talking 12 years to become qualified to do the work I was doing in Brazil. It's not a light thing to say, hey, I'm going to be a missionary, and then all of a sudden you're on the field and you're doing it. Maybe with some missions, but not, you know, that's not the right way to go about things. It was a huge investment in me to be able to do this. And I'm a country boy at heart. Grew up with this love for wilderness and all that, and here I am in the city of Belo Horizonte, Brazil. Has anyone heard of Belo Horizonte? I got one hand. Wow. Usually there's two. How many of you guys have heard of the nation of Finland? Raise your hands if you have. Okay, Finland has 5.5 million people in it, same as Belo Horizonte. Okay, you've all heard of Finland, never heard of Belo. It's Brazil's third largest city. It's an industrial city, a lot of major heavy industry going on there. It's not a flashy city with lots of beaches and monuments and things like that. It's just a working man's city. And it's an urban jungle. And my father-in-law was still on the field. My father and mother-in-law, my wife's parents, were still on the field then. And after a couple of months of working in this urban jungle, I'm getting pretty beat up. This is not me, you know? And he's like, hey, we got to take you out, get you out of the city for a while. And he takes me, we drive an hour south of Belo Horizonte, and we are in the howling wilderness. It's amazing. There's more wilderness surrounding that city than any other major city you can imagine. Literally, you drive out of the city, you're in the wilderness in certain directions. And south of the city, if you come from the coastline of the Atlantic coast there, you have what's called the Atlantic Range, which is, they call it the Mata Atlantica, the Atlantic Bush, and it's a rainforest. And the rain coming up off the ocean just all falls there. And then as it gets higher, it gets drier, and you run into a landform called Cerrado, which is like desert scrub brush. And then above that, there's mountains that go up to 6,000 feet in central Brazil. They don't get snow, but they get ice on top of them in the winter. And we found a place called the Waimi Forest where you had, in the lowlands, it was single canopy rainforest jungle. In the higher lands, in the dry season, it turned into desert. And then we had those mountains that go up to 6,000 feet. They bordered it. And I could literally park my car at the same ranch where I had permission to park. And in the rainy season, I'm doing wilderness survival training in jungle. And in the dry season, I'm doing the same thing, you know, wilderness survival training in desert, real desert, where it's hard desert. Where in the world could you do that? And God put me exactly in the place that he wanted me to be, a place that I was going to fall in love with. And every chance I got, I was getting stressed out. I would go out there, and that was my pressure release valve. I go out there in the wilderness, and every time I'm seeing new plants, new animals, it was just a wonderland for me. And of course, I come back, and now I'm a youth pastor. I'm showing my kids at church downtown. This is what I did this week. I went to this place, and they're like, oh, Pastor Mac, you got to take us out there. We got to see this. And I'm thinking, you know, these guys have lived their whole lives, and it's just over there. It's just, you know, a 45-minute car drive from church, and they've never been outside the city. They've never seen this. I thought, okay, this would be good, you know, stretch their minds a little bit. Guys, I take them out there. It was an unmitigated disaster. All right, these kids had never set foot off the pavement. I would tell them, guys, you got to get things, you know, situated. It's going to get dark. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, it's 5:30. It will be pitch black by 6:30. Yeah, all right. That's the level of disconnect these kids had with nature. The sun goes down, and out here, the streetlights don't come on. It does get dark, pitch black dark. You know, they're jumping off of rocks into the river and stuff and doing those crazy things. And I'm thinking, one of these kids is going to die. And I will be held responsible for this, you know? And I got them all home safe, and I'm like, never again. I am done with that. And they're showing all their friends, and they're talking this thing up. Pastor Mac, you got to take us out again. We got to do this again. And okay, I'll take you out there, but I'm going to teach you basic wilderness survival. Okay, shelter, fire, water, signals, navigation, food, some first aid. If you can master those disciplines, you can handle the wilderness, okay? Shelter, fire, water, signals, navigation, and food. With first aid, you're good. And I said, and you, it's not going to be the same thing. You're going to listen to what I say, and you're going to do what I say, all right? First time I get these guys out, there's like 6, 8 of them, got them in the jungle. I said, guys, look around. Do you see your mother here? No, I am not your mother. I'm not here to chop your wood. I'm not here to make your bed. I'm not here to carry your water. I am not here to make your fires and maintain your fires. I am here to train you how to do these things. Are we clear? Here's how it works. I'm going to do the thing. You're going to watch me do the thing. The very next time that thing has to be done, you will be doing the thing. Because I'm not here to, you're not kids. I'm here to train you to be adults in the forest, in the wilderness, and to handle yourselves. And it's like, bing, this light bulb goes off. You're a missionary. This is exactly what you're supposed to be doing. You're not here to evangelize Brazil. You're here to train Brazilians to evangelize Brazilians. You're not here to be a pastor. You're here to train people how to be pastors. You're not here to do, you're here to train, pour yourself into these folks and train them to do the work of the ministry, because it will crush you if you don't. And it won't get done. And that was the birth of the Per Ardua Wilderness Ministry. Now, Per Ardua is the McIntyre family motto. It means, in Latin, through difficulty. It's also the motto of the Royal Air Force. And I contend that the McIntyres had it first. So I'm not, you know, per ardua. I know everything I know about my God I learned in the midst of my deepest trials and greatest pains. Maybe you've picked up on that pattern. Amen. You know, the good times don't teach like the hard times. and everything's going smooth and everything's gravy, it doesn't teach you, it doesn't force you to your knees. And I know in my life, every time I've been stressed out and I've had honest suffering going on, I've learned. And by taking these kids out of the city, putting them in the wilderness is a perfect cause and effect relationship. You literally make your bed and then you lie in it. If you don't purify the water you're drinking, you get sick today. You know, you have to function. You have to pull together. You have to take care of each other. If I had 6 kids going out, I only had 5 ration packs. Okay, here's the food. You got one. You go, oh man, I'm one short. Sorry. Sucks to be you. Walk away. And what do they do? Oh man, okay, you don't have any food? Okay, we'll break this up. We'll even it out. Well, one time on a paid course, I had a guy that refused to actually chip in. And he almost got the crap beat out of him by the other students. Then we actually pulled back and let it happen because he's a trust fund kid. Oh my goodness. I digress. It was just a wonderful ministry opportunity. One of the things I would do, if I've got 5 kids, they're out of their packs weight about 20 pounds. And they're doing hardcore wilderness survival training. This is no easy thing. And I'd have them out there for 4 days. And on the last day, I'd make them draw straws, and whoever got the short straw had to carry all the packs, including mine. And we're in this river valley. They got like a 2-mile hike to get up out of this river valley, and it's steep. And in the jungle, it's, you know, it's shady, but as soon as you get up on the slope, it's bold sunlight and rock, and it's... So the kid that would draw that short straw, he'd be like, all right, I can do it. He's tough, you know what I mean? Kids meet this with pride. You know, I can handle it. And usually it was the most prideful kid that would draw that straw. And the other kids are all dancing around there, happy. You get to carry all the packs. And okay, then the one pack goes on the front, other pack goes on the back, and they're going to pack over here, pack over there, pack on top. Now the kid's carrying about 100 pounds. And it's no small thing. And now we start hiking out. I can do it. I got it. About a quarter way up that slope. They're huffing. The sweat's coming down. And the other kids are kind of getting quiet. And they're going up and up and up. And Pastor Mac, can we get our packs? No, man, I'm good. No, Pastor Mac, can we get our packs? No, you can't. Oh, come on. This isn't fair. Come on, Pastor Mac. Some of the kids are practically in tears. How can you let this go on? So we get to this flat spot up halfway up, and it's in the shade. And I'd say to him, why am I doing this? Well, I don't know. It isn't right. You know, it's not fun anymore. I said, this is your average church right here. You got one guy, one small team of people carrying the load for everybody. And if it needs to be done, they're the ones who are going to show up. And everyone else is just dumping packs on them. And what does God say? We're supposed to carry our own burdens and carry the burdens of others. You know, there are people that are wounded who need their burdens carried. And there's other people that are doing great. And they're getting their burdens carried. And it doesn't have to be that way. And these lessons would stick with these kids. You get the same group of kids together 5 years after they've been out on Parardua, and that's all they talked about. It was that impact. It was like a rite of passage. They had this Brazilian page called, it was like Facebook, a Brazilian version of Facebook, or Kuch. And they had a page on there, I suffered in the wilderness with Pastor Mac. And you had to have gone on the Parardua adventure to actually be part of that thing. But it was a great ministry. I loved it. And ministry in Brazil was really good. My wife was working with kids who had been sexually abused and molested. And I had this wilderness ministry I was developing and a youth pastorate. And one by one, all the 5 couples that we were supposed to work with there closed up shop and left, went home. Supposed to be a team of 5 couples. In 2008, the dollar took a 55% nosedive. We were living on 45% of what we had previously been making. It wasn't all roses. It wasn't all good. Aside from the challenges of just being in the ministry, which are a challenge in itself, there's the rampant crime going on, economic hardship. The kicker came, though, when my wife was noticing some changes in my daughter's behavior. He was 13 at the time. And my wife found her diary and started reading it. And she's talking about typical 13-year-old kid stuff. And then all of a sudden, there's these passages about these 2 28-year-old guys who had been grooming her and sexually molesting my daughter. And they were living with my in-laws. at the time, and were considered members of the family. And it got ugly, all right? This is not to cast shade on anybody, but it wasn't handled well by anybody, including myself and my wife. This was a major, major problem. And it ended up that I started taking my daughter Erin to counseling there in Brazil. Every Monday, I'd drive an hour to Pedro Leopoldo, and there was a Brazilian woman who was an expert in this and was giving her counseling. And we did that for 2 years. And then one day, Erin decided to go across the street. Our neighbors across the street were, the man of the house was a soccer coach for one of the national teams. I could be living across the coach of, you know, one of your major football teams. And he's like the head coach of the team. Well, actually, he was the defensive coach of this major football team, major league team. Very respectable family. And Erin and their daughter were really close friends. And their daughter had a little boy named Jonathan. So Mayada, the girl, asked Erin to come over and watch Jonathan because she was having a migraine headache, wanted to take some medicine and knock herself out. This is so typical. I mean, if Jonathan and Mayada were not in our house, Erin was over there with them every day. And she's like, okay, I'm going over to Mayada's house, going to take care of Jonathan. I'll be back here in a couple hours. Okay, no problem. She's right across the street, literally from here to that exit sign. I can call her. Did not know it, but Mayada had a half-brother who was on the run for killing a federal police officer at the time. And he was estranged from the family. He was the one they didn't talk about. And he came home, jumped over the wall of the house, found my daughter in there, and found his sister unconscious, basically, and he raped my daughter. Brutalized her. And again, it wasn't handled well. It was kind of treated as more proof that the McIntyres have an out-of-control kid. All right. And that kind of started a chain of events that ended up 2 years later, my wife said, we're getting a divorce. We're done. And she chucked it all, including me. And there was nothing I could do about it. I don't believe in divorce, but I have to believe that I'm divorced. And she went through with it, and I remember agonizing over it, and we left the mission, and we left Brazil, and we put our house on the market, and I find myself living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I have a job inspecting foreclosed homes. I'm not in the ministry anymore. I'm not married anymore. I'm not a dad. I see my kids once every 2 weeks. And between alimony and child support, I had about $200. After rent and utilities, I had about $200 to live on a month. You know, eating like canned ham and taco shells. And paying my bills and doing the best I can. But I was completely burned out to organized religion, churches. I didn't lose my faith. But I did not want to be involved with people at all. And I'm going from empty house to empty house. It's like living after the zombie apocalypse. And I had read this book by Jeff Mannion, who's a pastor there in Grand Rapids, called The Land Between. And I'm reading this book, and it really helped me a lot. And I determined that, okay, when I move to Grand Rapids, am I on here again? When I move to Grand Rapids, I'm going to go to this guy's church and check it out. But I was so not okay with going to churches. I just put it off. And finally, the Holy Spirit just kind of convicted me. I got to go to this church. I go to the church, and he says, okay, we're starting a new series of messages, a six-week program of messages called Rebuilding a Life. And I'm like, really? You know, why can't it be Rebuilding a Life? 6 weeks? All right, Lord, obviously you want me to hear these messages, so I'll go to the church for 6 weeks, and I'm done. And by the time the 6 weeks were up, I was involved in a men's group, small group for men, and really loving it. Ended up staying there in that small group for about 4 years. But those guys patched me back together and held me together while I was going through a really, really dark time in my life. Okay, so one day I go into work, and they say, well, we lost the contract for Michigan and 17 other states, and we're closing our doors, and you're out of a job in 2 weeks. You're done. And I am like, man, at this point in life, I can't win for losing. You know, that's what I felt like. Now, even just at the point where my self-identity is, I'm the guy that inspects the foreclosures in West Michigan, I lose that. I don't even have that. It was about then I get this Facebook message. You look like a great candidate for our show. Could you apply? And I'm like, what is this? A loan? Okay, never heard of it. Season one hadn't even aired yet. And I'm like, I open up the thing and they say, we will send you to a wilderness area somewhere in the world. You will be completely 100% alone. There is no camera crew. You will self-document your experience. You will live off the land with no outside help. Last man standing competition. The last person to leave the bush wins $500,000. I'm like, I could do that. Yep, $500,000? Sure, I'll take that. It's a Hail Mary pass at life. You know what I mean? He's like, okay, we're just going to apply for this wilderness survival show. And I applied, and I got a phone call. And they wanted an email. They wanted to set up a phone call. Now they want to set up a Skype interview. And now they want me to get an hour worth of unedited video footage of me in the wilderness, send that into them, casting tape. And they're asking for all this stuff. And I'm moving right through. And then after a while, I didn't hear anything. And all of a sudden, I get this package. It's a background check. I mean, it's a thorough background check. I'm thinking, wow, they're spending money on this thing. They're considering me for real. And I fill that out. And then, long story short, they call me back in August of 2015. They offered me a chance to go to boot camp. Now, boot camp, they take 3,500 people applied for season two. And they're taking 20 people to boot camp in New York to actually interact with them and throw them against the wall to see if they stick. And I get to go there, and I show up at boot camp, and I'm looking around at the competition. Okay, the Air Force has the survival escape resistance and evasion course, SEER, and every pilot has to take that course. And now they have the instructor of that course, Mike Lowe, is there as one of the contestants, you know, trying a first slot on this show. He taught the Air Force Survival School. Randy Champagne, instructor at the Boulder Outdoor Survival School. Jose Amoedo, who was bodyguard of the King of Spain, Spanish Foreign Legion, Special Forces, lives in the Yukon and has been adopted by an Indian tribe. Dr. Nicole Apelian, master's degree from the Pacific Northwest, lives on that coastline, spent 2 years living with the sand bushmen in Africa and helped hunt poachers. You know what I mean? And there's like, hi, I taught kids Bible in Brazil. You know what I mean? I'm just like this total lightweight and very intimidated. And they took us out for the, you know, they do the whole, you know, physical, turn your head and cough, all that, you know, good stuff. And then they take you out to the woods and they put you through your paces. And the first thing they had us do was make they gave us a piece of paracord, parachute cord about a meter long and said, take your knife, go make a fire. No matches, no lighter, nothing. They're talking make a friction fire in a woods that you don't even know. And I'm the only person that got it done out of the 20 people there. A couple others got it done afterwards, made it work, but I was the one who made it work in time. And all of a sudden, I'm like the guy to watch. Another thing they did was they hiked us in. I'm not allowed to tell you certain things. I've said too much probably already about boot camp. But anyway, there was another event where only 7 people got it done successfully, and I was one of them. So all of a sudden, I'm like the guy to watch, and it was totally not expected. And I said, Lord, if you don't want me to do this, don't let me succeed. Let me fail out here, because the more they talked about it, the more I wanted to do it. I said, if you don't want me to do this, just pull back and let me fail. And it was like his hand was just on me, you know, and just giving me everything I needed to do what I had to do. So a week goes by after boot camp, and they call me up and had a Skype interview, and they offered me a position as one of the 10 contestants on a loan. Now, we're going to Vancouver Island. The north end of Vancouver Island is called the Rain Coast for a reason. It gets 12 feet of rain a year. In the fall, the area temperatures are like mid-40s to low 30s and raining every day, today. This is Vancouver Island. When it's not raining, it's this heavy mist coming down. Okay, and it's 35 degrees and raining every day, every day. And then the sun comes out, and then it goes away, and then it sleets, and then you get a storm, 60-mile-an-hour winds. It's a crazy place. So I had a month to get my stuff in order. A couple days before I go to Vancouver Island for orientation, I'm driving my Jeep, have all my guns in it. I'm taking to a friend's house so he can take care of my guns. Bam, I get rear-ended, totaled my Jeep. I'm just parked at a stoplight, and wham, I get hit from that by 45 miles an hour from behind. It just totally blows my Jeep up. I spent the last money on gear for the show. It cost me about $2,000 to buy all the stuff I needed. That was the last of the money I had because I was unemployed. My daughter moved into my apartment as soon as I left because she was having major problems with my ex-wife. And I'm on Vancouver Island. And now it's drop day, and we're going to go. And it was September 20th. And I got up in the morning. I didn't wake up. I got up, and I couldn't bring my Bible. I couldn't bring no pencil, no books, Bibles, paper, pens, nothing, okay? And I opened up this Bible, and I just laid it on the bed, and it opened up to the middle, which is Isaiah chapter 40, and in the NIV here, it's titled, it says, Comfort for God's People. I'm like, yeah, I could use some of that. So I start reading this whole chapter. And a lot of you guys have probably memorized the end of Isaiah chapter 40, but you don't remember what it is, do you? I didn't either. I memorized these verses long ago. I'm reading all the way down. I come to verse 29. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And I wept. That broke me. This is not my first rodeo wilderness survival. I've done a lot of this stuff. I know how much it hurts. I know how much you're going to starve. I know how miserable it can be. And I know how weary it can be. And here I am, a 50-year-old man going out to do this stuff. I wept. I got my rain, I had a Gore-Tex rain jacket, camouflage rain jacket, and I turned the hood inside out, and I got a pen, and I wrote that verse out. I printed it out inside the hood, and I wanted that right here, okay? And I took that as a promise. So then we get in the boat, we drive 45 minutes down the coast, and I had no idea what body of water I was on. It was either, pretty much sure that it was Quatsino Sound, okay? I get up there, we're driving along, we pull into this rocky coastline, this big wide cove with an island and a reef and this giant kelp forest, and we're driving over top of it. They pull up to the beach, okay, this is it, get out. Your camera gear's up there, see you next week. And they would come out every 7 to 10 days to check on us, make sure we were still alive and all the lights were blinking and that the cameras, yeah, they'd get our footage and give us new batteries and that sort of thing. Very quick, perfunctory stop. Once a week. So what is wilderness survival all about? How do you do it? Like I said, shelter, fire, water, signals, navigation, and food. Now, shelter, fire, and water, that allows you to stay where you are. If I have a dry roof over my head, a dry place to sleep, a fire in front of me with a pot of water boiling away, what do you call that? Camping. All right? You're just camping. And that's the whole goal of wilderness survival, is to get yourself into a position where you can fall asleep naturally. Not pass out from exhaustion, but to lay down at night and actually fall asleep. Because if you can fall asleep, your body has enough food, it's been hydrated, it's nice and warm, you're not hypothermic, you're not in grave danger, you can fall asleep. Now, you do that every day. That's your whole goal. You're doing that by nature every day, where you're going to eat food, you're going to drink water, you're going to sleep in a nice dry place that's safe. And you're just trying to replicate those conditions in a place where it's difficult to replicate those types of conditions. Signals allows the rescuer to find you, and barring that, navigation allows you to self-rescue by getting yourself back to civilization. And it's all, you're mitigating the risks. You're deciding, what do I need to take with me to mitigate those risks? What are the things I need to carry with me to make that happen? Okay, my own father broke his leg in a hunting accident one time, all by himself. If he had a whistle, opening day is deer season in Wisconsin. First thing he does is fires 3 shots from his .30-06 carbine. And opening day of deer season in Wisconsin. Gentlemen, what did he just say? That man cannot hunt. That is a lousy shot. Firing 3 rounds in rapid succession at a deer, this guy's a greenhorn, lightweight idiot. Now, what would have happened if he had a whistle with him and started blowing that whistle and blowing that whistle and blowing that whistle? Who would have found him? A lynch mob of hunters, right? Would have come to strung this guy up. Oh, he's one of us and he broke his leg. Okay, let's help the guy out. Got it. All right, but I'm not going to signal for rescue. I had a satellite phone. I could call them up at any moment and say, I'm done, get me. You could tap out at any moment for any reason. And I'm not going to do that. I'm not leaving. I'm not going to navigate out of here. So what's my problem? My problem is food. Now, you can survive 3 minutes without air, 3 hours of exposure to extremes of heat or cold, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food. That's a general rule of thumb. So I've got 21 days now to figure out the food problem there in my cove. Guys, I'm looking around. I can't find anything. I'm seeing no fish, no crabs. There's no game. And I'm really, about 7 days in, I had my first meal, which was basically bait, fish bait, which I'm pulling out of the rocks and made like a seafood boil out of that. But day six, I found this really nice place to just kind of chill and look out, and I started to pray. I said, Lord, you've taken everything away from me. there is nothing left of my former life. Nothing. I'm not in the ministry. I'm not married. I'm not really a parent much anymore. My beautiful home is still on the market in Brazil. It hasn't sold. It's just a burden to me. I have no money in the bank. I have no vehicle. I have no apartment. The only thing I have left to lose is my life and my health, and you have taken me to the highest concentration of cougars and black bears on the planet with no food, no weapon, and obviously you're doing something. And I'm okay with it. And I honestly thought I was going out on a backboard with a broken leg, compound fracture, head injury, broken arm, something was going to take me out of this one of these days, and I'll be done with this adventure. And what he did was he started to starve me down. It was 14 days before I caught my first fish, 2 weeks of basically total fasting, you know, eating bait, boiled bait. It's a broth, basically. And I had a gill net that I brought with me, a commercial gill net. I made a second gill net. I found this rope, and I took it all down to its basic fibers and carved a net needle and, you know, put a recent rope I found, and I actually wove myself a whole second gill net out there and attached it to my other one, so I'd have double the gill net size, you know, for catching fish. And every day I go out there and check that gill net, it will be full of bull kelp. Bull kelp is like floating rope, and it's huge and heavy, and it would catch in the net. So I'd spend all my low tide time pulling, you know, repairing the net, pulling it out, getting it all set up again, and try again tomorrow, and every day it's just full with kelp. And one night on day 30, I come out to my net, and it was set up on a rock wall on the beach, and all this stretched across to this big heavy tripod tied down to a rock that would keep the whole thing anchored. And during the night, that thing came down and the surf just rolled the whole net into a ball. And I come out and I see this thing and I shut off the camera because I know what's about to happen. I didn't want to be the Baptist preacher guy who's dropping F-bombs on national TV, because that's how I'm just telling you that, just keeping it real, guys. And I wanted to take that net and just throw it through the woods, and it hadn't caught me anything yet, and I was really angry, and I look in the middle of that net, and there's this gigantic northern kelp crab all tangled up in that net. And they got claws like a lobster. I mean, they're really heavy claws. And I'm too much of a Scotsman to just pull my knife and cut through the net and, you know, grab the crab. I got to untangle this blankety-blank net. So start untangling. And the more I untangle, the more angry I'm getting. And I'm just like beside myself. And I'm like, I am doing right now everything that I have taught other people to do in wilderness survival. You get your passive fishing infrastructure set up. It's working for you. It's, you know, catching fish while I'm sleeping or doing other things. And then you go around and you actively hunt and fish as you can. But this is the priority. And every time I set it up, just wave after wave of destruction just tears it down. And this is your life. There's a very wrong-headed idea of spirituality that says if you really want your life to count for God, you're going to be either a Christian school teacher, a pastor, or a missionary. My Christian school kind of hammered that into me, and it's not true. But I have been all three. Any objective observation of Dave McIntyre's life is this is a guy who wants his life to count for God. I mean, he's a Christian school teacher, pastor, missionary, doing all this, you know, full-time vocational ministry was my life. And my life was a total shipwreck. Literally, I am washed up in the middle of nowhere here. This is your life. And it was the first time I could see me all of a sudden. God starved me down to this shell of my former self. I'm a living stick figure at this point. Lost 35 pounds at that point. And I could all of a sudden see my contribution to my failing. My family sank. My ministry sank. And I was at the helm. And I don't know if you've been through a divorce, but you go through a divorce, you hear about everything you ever did wrong in the 25 years we were married, and you're rejecting it. You're not listening. You're not taking it in. You're just in defend your dignity mode. Any shred of dignity you can get, you're just trying to survive that experience. And God broke me down to nothing, and he showed me me. And all of a sudden, I got it, and I'm repenting, and I'm crying, and I'm saying, Lord, you know, I did neglect my wife. I did do horrible decisions. Never cheated on her, nothing like that. But it was like, in all those decisions I had to make, I did not guard her, okay? I didn't protect her in a lot of things. And I was a jerk. I had to admit it. And God forgave me. It's a curious thing now, you know. How is it that we can go to God and ask him to forgive us for the pain we caused to other people? Third-party forgiveness. Sir, I hurt you horribly. Will you forgive me for that? Wait a minute. Whoa. How does that work? Why is that just? How is it I can ask my God to forgive me for offending my wife horribly, and he just did? He didn't ask her. Hey, I've got Mac on the beach. He's weeping mess, and he's begging me to forgive him. Can I do that? Do I have your approval to do that? He doesn't ask that, does he? Never. I'll tell you why he doesn't do that. He paid for those sins. He paid for my sin on that cross. He owns them. Not me, not her. He bought them with his blood. And one by one, he forgave me those things because he owned them. And he offered me that forgiveness, and I took it. Until there wasn't nothing left. There wasn't anything left I had to pray about. He just stopped bringing them up, bringing them into mind. And he gave me like a 5-minute break. And I looked down and there's a whole other bucket of rot right there. There's people in that bucket. A lot of them. People that did things to my daughter that make a man go out and buy a shovel and a bag of lime and start making plants. And I did that. I laid awake for 2 years, plotting how to get away with murder. Had a good plan, too. He stayed my hand on more than one occasion, and I am now looking at that person in that bucket. And I know what I got to do. I've got to forgive him. Because you know who paid for the sins that person did against me and my daughter and my family? Same person who just forgave me. And who am I? Okay, Lord, I receive your forgiveness. Thank you. Oh, but this guy here. Oh, wait a minute. No. Hold on. I'm going to insert myself in between my God who paid the price for those sins and that man because I want my pound of flesh. I want to cut that man's throat. And there was a day I walked past one of those guys on the street in Belo Horizonte, and I always had my knife, and I was that close to slashing this guy's throat. With that grinny out on his face, like, you can't do jack. And I almost did jack. And God stayed my hand. But now I got to let this guy go? I got to forgive this guy? And I felt all that rage, all that pain, all that anger. And I said, Lord, the one thing that gave me comfort in that, give place for the wrath of God. Do not take your own revenge, but give place to the wrath of God. And that's a very easy verse to obey when nobody's messing with your life and your family. When no one's raped your daughter, it's easy to go by to do that, to not take your own revenge. But when you are facing that and it's real and you can do something about it, now you got a problem. You either forgive or you become a murderer. Or you let it eat you up night after night after night, which was my solution. So there on the island, I had to forgive these guys, and I forgave them. One by one, I forgave them. And people kept coming up out of that bucket, and the Lord kept showing me people I had thought I had forgiven, but I hadn't. And I forgave them. And the more I did it, the easier it became. And he started with the worst and went to the least. And guys, after that, I was light as a feather. There was nothing. And I had a crab. And I took that giant crab back to my shelter, and I cooked it up. And he was cool. He was dead. He was just dead crab. And I threw him on the woodpile, and I'm making a fire. And I look over. He's like, he's like, what are you going to do about it? So I killed him. You know what I mean? I'm like, rip you up, boiled him up, and I'm eating this crab. And I said, Lord, when I get out of here, I'm going to an all-you-can-eat crab place. I'm going to pig out on crabs. They're amazing. I mean, think about it, guys. They eat dead fish that fall to the bottom of the ocean and taste like crabs. That is God loving us. And a couple days later, I'm out fishing. And I'm looking through the water at the bottom, you know, through the kelp, and I see this thing going like this. And I look over, and there's a northern kelp crab just flipped over on his back on the top of the kelp. And I threw a limpet on him, my bait, and he grabbed it. And I pulled up, and he grabbed into the kelp, and I'm fighting him. He's fighting me. I relaxed. He relaxed. Whew, flew him right up into the rocks on a line and hook. And I look out, and there's five more. I caught 6 crabs that night. And I had my all-you-could-eat crab feast right there on Vancouver Island, surrounded by millions of crabs. You know, God didn't send me home for that. So that became a second food source for me. I probably ate 60 of those northern kelp crabs. I was up there. I kept calling them Dungeness crabs on the show because that's the only crab I knew about up there. And the Canadians are quite upset with me for calling northern kelp crabs Dungeness crabs, their famous crab. But be that as it may, for me, I was eating like $26 a pound crabs in my head, you know, and living like a king. And there comes a point where you're applying the best of your ideas to the best of your discoveries, right? You're doing everything you know with everything you've been given, and you're making this thing work, and you hope to get to a day. My motto out there, my mantra was, make tomorrow an easier day. No matter what I do today, I have to do it to make tomorrow an easier day to live than today. And you're getting food, and you're eating, and I'm getting to the point where it's a sustainable lifestyle. I actually started regaining weight that I had lost. My maximum weight loss was week 5. And after that, I was gaining weight until the end. And you're not learning anything. It just becomes a really hard life. And you're just living this lifestyle of hand to mouth, working 12 hours a day to get one bowl of food and then go to bed and do it again. And I remember day 64 comes around. And season 1 ended on day 56. We're like a week later now than that. And obviously, there's someone still out there. I don't know how many people are going. They don't tell you. And I'm just head down trying to work. Day 64, I caught this one little fish, like 6-inch long greenling, and that's all I caught that day. And I'm searching all my crab places. I'm searching all the place, all my good fishing places. I'm hitting, and I'm getting nothing, nothing, nothing. And my northwest coast was a really good, productive place. I had gone all the way to the end of it, and it was sleeting and cold and windy, and I came all the way back, and the tide's coming in, and I sat down in a place called the Fight Chair. I caught a really big fish there once. And I'm going to fish here at the Fight Chair because there's a cliff right next to me, and as the tide's coming in, if I don't get around that cliff before the tide cuts it off, I can't get off this coastline. It was like the last obstacle. So I'm sitting there, and I'm grumbling. I'm just angry. I'm not having a good day. I've got this one little fish, which is like an insult. It's like being a waiter and getting a 25-cent tip. You know what I mean? It's like I worked all day, and now I have to actually make a fire to cook this little tiny glorified minnow. And I'm sitting there fishing. I got my hood up. My camera's laying on the ground. I'm not filming anything. I'm just really miserable. And I got the bait in the water. I'm not even paying attention to it. I'm just sitting there. Maybe, hopefully, something will bite. And I'm praying. I said, Lord, I'm not learning anything new here. I don't know what's going on. This is just like pulling wings off a fly at this point. It's just misery. It's just, you know, what? And someone else is going through this. Go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. My voice in my head, not my idea. Now, if your theology can't handle that, your problem. Okay? Low blood sugar and fatigue. You're good. And I'm like, well, that's just dumb. It's all seaweed to get down to that flat rock down the bottom. Then it's bull kelp, which is filled with, it's like floating rope. The natives would anchor their boats to bull kelp. That's how strong this stuff is. You cast into bull kelp, you lose a hook. And so I'm like, well, that's dumb. I would put my head, go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. My voice in my head, this time, it's not suggesting. It's telling me straight up. Do that. Okay. All right, Lord. What's going on here? I don't know. I go down there and I stand on that rock, and the waves are going past me this way. They're not coming at me, you know. And the bull kelp is kind of, it's not full high tide yet, so it's not underwater. It's kind of laid on the surface, and the waves are kind of washing it back and forth like this, and there's a hole in the middle. And I took my pole is like 12 feet long and had another 15 feet of line on it. And I swing it out there, and I drop it in that hole. And then the waves kind of went out, and bam, I'm hooked in the bull kelp. Snagged. I mean, hard. I pull back, and it's just rock solid snagged. And I know if I pull hard enough, I'm just going to get it's just going to break the hook, and that's it. The waves come in again. I'm still in the bull kelp, but my line is going out, and all the bull kelp moves in like this, and my line's still pulling the opposite direction. And I'm like, what? And I pull back on there. Sea perch comes out of the water like this. Lands in the rocks behind me. Now, I had found this big nail. I called it my pink handle prison shank. I had this big old nail. I sharpened it up and had this pink ribbon stuff. I made a braided handle for it, and that was tied into my wool jacket. I pull that thing out, I jump on this fish, and I'm shanking this fish for all I'm worth. I'm like stabbing it, and blood's flying out of it because I'm on a slope like this. If I don't kill that fish dead, it's gonna be gone. So I'm shanking the fish and getting all splattered with blood and everything and laughing and crying at the same time. All right, and I get the fish out of there, and I get up, and I set up my camera. I said, people, this is the grace of God. This is God taking care of me. If he takes his hand off of me, I'm dead. But this is the mercy of God. And they used that audio, but they didn't use that visual, because I must have looked crazy as ever, the wild eyes and blood on my face. Not a good look for the show. But I said wise and powerful words, I guess, and they used those. So I go home, and I fillet this fish out on day 64, and I had a 2-quart pot, and half of it was fish. I had an entire quart compacted of just fish in this stew with some, bull kelp, and I could barely finish it. And that was not the only meal I'd had. I was consistently gaining weight, but here I am, day 64, and I'm eating this. I could barely finish that stew. Day 65, I caught a couple fish and a couple crabs, had a really good meal that night, really calm day, sunny, beautiful, and not warm, but sunny. And I went to bed that night, and I woke up in like 1 o'clock in the morning on day 65, and the moonlight was shining on my tarp. I'd never seen that. Vancouver Island is pitch black at night. It is always overcast, and you're living in a forest which is impossibly dense. You see nothing, not your hand in front of your face on Vancouver Island. And now I can look out, and I can see my campsite, and I see patches of moonlight on the tarp, and I get up to go to the bathroom, and it was cold. It was like maybe 30 degrees, and I'm not in my whole outfit. I'm just wearing the nylon pants I would wear underneath, all that other stuff, and my wool, like a wool hoodie. And I'm getting out there, I'm taking a leak, and I'm getting kind of cold. I'm like, I need to get back in my sleeping bag before it cools off. I don't want to have to do that again. That's all I'm thinking. And I turn to go in. If you knew this was your last night in the bush, you'd go out to the beach and have a look. But probably would if I knew it was my last night, but I don't know that, and I'm really cold, I'm going to go to bed. And that's what I'm thinking. I turn to go in. If you knew this was your last night in the bush, you'd go out to the beach and have a look. Again, my voice, my head, not my idea, and now it's not asking. It's just kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I didn't quite get it that moment, but I turned on my headlamp and went out to the beach. Now, I had seen this place with 65-mile-an-hour winds, storm, horizontal hail kind of thing, And it is dead quiet. Quatsino Sound is a sheet of glass. Not a ripple on it, not a breath of wind moving. The water at the edge is just kind of moving like this, just kind of moving a couple inches. Dead calm. Not a cloud in the sky. Stars, full moon, beautiful. Stayed out there for like half an hour, 40 minutes, got really, really cold and went back to bed. I wake up the next morning and it is day 66 and you guys get to see that. So go ahead and show that video. Up and it's really, really cold. Sitting out in the sunshine, trying to get warm. And I'm thinking, God, if they don't pull me out of here today, you're going to have to encourage me because I'm ready for this thing to be done.
I stay with it one day at a time. And I keep that focus one day at a time. I don't try it and think about how long I've been here or how long I could possibly be here. Good job. Right now, I feel like I'm coming out of the tunnel. I feel like this thing is coming to a logical conclusion at some point.
104 over 72 is your heart rate. Blood pressure, sorry.
I mean, I can't stay out here forever. I miss my kids, amazing,
really bad. I mean, I try not to think about my kids, you know, and but I know that they love me. I know that they want me to be out here as long as I can.
Day 66, David.
Wow. So why are you staying here so long anyways? Is it...
Why not? Yeah, I would love to win this thing. Of all the people that get a chance to do this thing, I get a chance to do it. You know, of all the people that applied for this thing and maybe got a chance to do it, I get to do it. So yeah, I want to do this. Why go home now? I'm eating crab. I mean, I am eating Dungeness crabs practically every night. Why would I go home now? So...
long time out here. You're doing a great job. I mean, it's work out here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Worth it?
Yeah. It's, you know, at 50 years old, to be able to do this for this long. And somebody said to me right before I left, boy, 50 hasn't slowed you down at all. And I'm like, yeah, baby. Yeah, that's what...
That was the same daughter that had gone through all that horror. All this way, just tell me.
Oh my goodness.
I don't want to miss this for the world.
I get to go on that boat today, don't I?
You're coming home.
I get to come home. Oh my goodness.
You get to come home.
Wow, $500,000. I don't even know what to do with it. I wouldn't even know. I'm pretty enthusiastic about figuring it out.
Yeah.
You know, no, there's some things I want to do to help you guys. And, yeah, beyond that, I don't know. I mean, I just have to feel my way through that, survive that.
You go ahead and stop it there. They didn't show something in that scene in between that helicopter and hugging my daughter. I had a total breakdown right there. I was thanking God. And I said to them, he gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And I said, that's how I did this. God gave me the strength because my strength ran out a long time ago. And moment by moment, day by day, he gave me the strength to stay out there. My strength was gone by day 40-something. I was done. Day by day, moment by moment, he gave me the strength as it depended on him and yielded that to him just by obeying and staying there. And I didn't even know it. I said, I'm going home in that boat, right? I'm going home in a boat. They flew me out of there in a helicopter. I literally left there on wings of eagles, guys. And they flew me to a cabin, me and Aaron, to a cabin where I had to stay for a couple days and reacclimate to being around human beings and stop being a savage and all that. And you are a savage. It's not a violent thing. It's good. It's Homo sapiens 1.0 programming. You are the base model. You know what I mean? It feels good to be that guy. You're like, God told Peter, rise, kill, and eat. Yeah. That was me. And they take me to this cabin, and I walk up, and they say, these two cabins for you and Aaron. You can have one, Aaron can have the other. I walked up to the cabin, open it up, and there over the bed is a picture of this bald eagle flying over Cuatzino Sound, right above the bed. And I'm like, all right, Lord, I get it. I get it. I go to the people that own the cabins. I said, is the artwork for sale? They said, this is Canada. It's all for sale. And I'm like, I'm a patron of the arts, man. I just won $500,000. I'm buying this. You know, paid 220 Canadian, and that's hanging in my house now, that picture, just as a reminder of his faithfulness. And if you watch the episodes, at the very end, when Larry Roberts taps out, the very next scene is this eagle just snatching a fish off the water, bald eagle swooping in, snatching a fish and going. And they put that in there for me because I'd quoted that verse to them. And that's what it meant to me. And a little too preachy for them for that final moment, but you know, they honor me by putting that scene in there. So after that, I go around the country telling this story in men's meetings and wild game dinners and men's retreats and for 2 years, and then COVID wiped that out. And I had a whole year's worth of very lucrative meetings just dropping off. And I said, Lord, what do you want me to do? You know, put me in line of battle where you want me to be and give me the grace to stand. And a week later, I got invited by the director of Set Free Ministries to consider the position of international director at Set Free Ministries. Currently, I have been doing that 2 years now. I've got 3,600 primary students in Uganda, Africa. 850 of those got saved this last year. And the year before that, 720 got saved. I'm working with, we have 1,000 volunteers, Set Free India. We have 1,000 volunteers in 9 state prisons, and we're working with about 5,000 people there. And again, you know, multiple hundreds of people getting saved in India, and I get to train the people that do those wonderful things. And God has taken, he took me down to nothing, and he rebuilt me to my dream job. I could not have designed a more perfect thing for me to be doing. With all my skills, training, education, all that, he gave it all back. Okay, and yeah, the money's long gone. It's all spent on houses, cars, educations, and all that stuff, but I am rich. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.